fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. At this time last year, the world was a very different place. The idea of lockdowns and social distancing had not yet entered our consciousness. Masks were something you wore on Halloween. A worldwide pandemic was something you read about in history books. In some ways, it's astonishing how much our worldview has shifted after a year of unprecedented challenges and change. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. Today on Route 51, it's our annual year in review, a look back at the many programs that entertained, informed, and intrigued listeners most from January through December. We'll hear performances from Paco Frelick, Adam Gruhl, and Ariane Leiden, as well as clips from some of our favorite and most impactful programs of 2020. Because this show was recorded previously, we won't be taking your calls today. In January, we had no idea that in just 2 short months, our lives would be turned upside down when the pandemic reached our local communities. We started the year by offering up ideas on how to cure cabin fever. Little did we know how important those tips would be just a few months later. Then, we welcomed Wausau School Board Vice President Pat McKee and Wausau therapist Lee Shipway to Route 51 for a frank discussion on bullying in local schools, the role of educators in mitigating the issue, and coping mechanisms to help children and parents deal with the problem. Here's a portion of that program.
How do you effectively empower children that way? I mean, how do you give them the coping skills, even as young children, to deal with this kind of stuff?
Well, I think as young children, we as parents need to try to teach our children right from wrong. We need to teach them that every human being is valued, no matter their age, their gender, their race, economic status, their disabilities or abilities, that every human being is worth as much as any other human being. And I think that is really at the crux of it. On that, you then build empathy for when they maybe see another child who's being mistreated, and then you help them to understand, if you don't feel comfortable going to someone at school, come to me as the parent, and then that parent making an agreement that I will say something, I will do something, I will back you up, I will back your friend up. And the more you do that and model that, I think it's all about modeling, then those kids grow up to understand that I do have some power, not just power, but I have a duty to help my fellow citizen.
And I think that word that you use, Shireen, advocate, you know, for your child, is 100% correct. And it goes back to two. I mean, asking them what's going on, what's happening, etc. But then when they tell you, actually acting upon it and making sure that you follow through. I had a situation like that when one of my children was in elementary school, you know, kind of like yourself. It was clearly a case of a child who was bullying one of my children. And he was telling me about it. And I said, okay, let's get in the truck. And we took a drive over. We happened to know where this child lived. Talked to his parents. He got out there. The child was very remorseful, started sobbing, and from that day forward, never happened again.
See, there you go.
Having that involvement is absolutely crucial. Unfortunately, not every child has a parent or someone that they trust who will do that for them. What about those children?
You know, that's a really tough question, and that's one of the things that always concerns me on the Youth Risk Behavior Survey is when they show the percentage of kids who say, I don't have a trusted adult at my school that I feel like I can go to. And the higher the grades go up, usually the more they say they don't have someone they can trust. Well, some of that is just because of adolescence, right? Adolescence, those years, kids just kind of pull away from adults. So I'm not really sure. It's like if they don't have someone at school, anybody in their life can make a difference. And this is something, a point I make to people all the time. So I hope people hear this. If you have a neighbor child who seems to be having a difficult time because maybe their parents aren't there, or maybe their parents have an alcohol or drug addiction, or there's something else going on in their life, don't consider, oh, that's none of my business. And have that child involved in your children's lives. You know, there's many times I can think of when my kids were little that we had neighbors where I knew things were not well at those families. And those kids always would show up at my house conveniently around mealtime. And I thought, I don't care. I'm feeding them. And so if you're at my house and you're a kid, you're going to get fed if you're there at mealtime. Because I knew they weren't really getting taken care of at the other home. there is a lot of truth to the adage that it takes a village to raise a child. And it does. So if you see a child in need, don't feel like it's none of my business. You know, intervene appropriately, respectfully as you can.
That was Lee Shipway with Pat McKee, a discussion on a neighborhood approach to dealing with bullying in schools. Later in January, Dr. Margaret Turnbull joined us for a fascinating look at the search for extraterrestrial life. If you've ever looked up at the stars at night and wondered who or what is out there, this program held a few answers with recent NASA discoveries and a discussion about what they mean to our universe. Here, Dr. Turnbull talks about the potential for life elsewhere in the universe.
So have the scientists there found life or at least evidence of life on any other planets so far?
No, but we're such at the beginning of our search. I mean, this is like we're just starting to appreciate how widespread planetary systems are. I mean, we now finally understand and can show that almost every single star in the galaxy does have a planetary system. That's news. Like for,
right.
You know, for the last thousands of years of astronomers looking at the sky, that was completely up for debate. Even just a couple decades ago, it wasn't known. Mm-hmm. Like, and not only that, we're starting to realize that the nature of those planetary systems is such that there are literally billions of stars in the galaxy that do have an Earth-sized planet in their habitable zone. So it's just statistically we know that that is the case. So the potential for life elsewhere is starting to get clarified in our minds so that we can start doing searches that would actually find and then start to characterize planets for signs of life.
That was Dr. Margaret Turnbull, a discussion on the ongoing search for extraterrestrial life as we continue our look back at the past 12 months on Route 51. You can hear archives of all our programs at wpr.org/Route 51. 2020 was a crucial election year, with dozens of local, state, and national seats up for grabs. One recurring theme throughout the year was our political coverage. It started in January with debates between Democrats Tricia Zunker and Lawrence Dale, followed by Republicans Jason Church and Tom Tiffany for the 7th U.S. Congressional District. Tom Tiffany ultimately won that race and now holds the seat once held by Republican Representative Sean Duffy. In February, we held our first of several legislative roundups with Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland and Republican State Representative Patrick Snyder. We explored the world of craft brewing and its economic impact on our region. We also hosted an important and timely discussion on Native American school mascots with Auburndale Superintendent James Delikowski, who spearheaded an effort to change the mascot at his schools. Barbara Munson, an Oneida Nation representative, had this to say about the issue.
A great deal of research has come to light since 2002, when Stephanie Freiberg's research started. And it was really the first research that dealt with the impact of Indian mascots on Native students and non-Native students. There's been a lot of research that we should have been able to get this from that just dealt with racial discrimination, the impact on Black-white identity issues, so on and so forth. But nobody was willing to listen until research that was specific to the impact of Indian mascots came to light, and that was in 2002. Freiberg found that exposure to Indian mascots did in fact harm the self-esteem of Native students, and that it created a boost to the self-esteem of European American students. That right there points out that we're dealing with racial discrimination, because when you have differential impact between groups like that, you're looking at something really unusual.
That was Barbara Munson discussing research on the impact school mascots can have on our Native American and non-Native American communities. Though we featured plenty of politics and serious discussions in 2020, our aim at Route 51 is to strike just the right balance in our programming. Part of that balance is a commitment to feature the music from incredible artists who live and perform in North Central Wisconsin. The pandemic limited our ability to connect in person with performing musicians. We were lucky enough to feature several Americana-style artists in an unforgettable program that is certainly one of our favorites for the year. Later in the hour, we'll share two more performances from that program, but right now, here's Paco Frelick, a National Native American Music Award-winning singer and songwriter from Rhinelander, with his original piece, The Great Divide. It's a song that captured the emotion and upheaval of 2020. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
The world is spinning faster and faster. It feels like we're going backwards. I'm running out of breath and out of time. What's it for day after day? It feels like a runaway train going round and round in circles in my mind. How will we cross this great divide? Between the earth and the sky, between our hearts and our minds, between you and I. Leave a better world behind. No war, no hunger, just peace of mind. No prejudice, just mankind. We are one, you and I, no great divide. Turn on the TV, what do they say? The same things as yesterday. Conflicts and politics crashing down on me. Another storm is on the horizon. It's all they're advertising till we're blinded by the fear. Can't you see? How will we cross this great divide? Between the earth and the sky, between our hearts and our minds, between you and I. Let's leave a better world behind. No war, no hunger, just peace of mind. No prejudice, just mankind. We are one, you and I, no great divide. We can dream it, then we can. We'll rise above it all when we realize we're not that different from each other. 'Cause you're my sister and I'm your brother, and together there's no mountain we can't climb. How will we cross this great divide between the earth and the sky? Between our hearts and our minds, between you and I. Let's leave a better world behind. No war, no hunger, just peace of mind. No prejudice, just mankind. We are one, you and I, no great divide. No great divide. No great divide. No great divide. There's no great divide. There's no great divide. There's no great divide.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert, guiding you through our annual year in review, a look back at the conversations that make 2020 a year to remember from January through December. Because this program was recorded earlier, we won't be taking your calls or emails today. News about the potential deportation of Hmong residents in north central Wisconsin raised alarm bells with many people in our local communities. In March, Yileng Zhang and Chai Mua joined us for a discussion about that issue and their concerns about the potential legislation that could have torn families apart. Part of the discussion revolved around the history behind the issue, which prompted thousands of Hmong soldiers and their families to flee.
Now, I still remember in the 1970s, the church my family attended sponsored a Southeast Asian family. It was one of the first Southeast Asian families that came to Wausau. They came here to resettle. And I was pretty young. I think I was 7 or 8 years old when this happened. And I don't know that I fully understood why they were here. I just knew what my church and what my family had told me, that these were people that needed our help, that they were escaping persecution. But I don't know that I had a full understanding of it back then. Maybe a little background would be helpful in understanding what's happening. So what was the Hmong role in the Vietnam War, and how did this whole thing start?
Sure. So back during the Vietnam War, because of the agreements that the United States had with the countries around it, it was not allowed to enter into Laos due to the fact that Laos was a neutral country during that. However, North Vietnam had a trail that was going through the country of Laos, and that trail was known as the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So, in order for the United States to counter any supplies from being transported from the North Vietnam to South Vietnam, they ended up hiring or bring on individuals or ethnics in Laos, specifically Hmong individuals, Cambodians, Khmers, and the whole goal was for them to disrupt the supplies that would be transported along that trail. Now, the Hmong community and the members of the Laotian community, these guerrilla warriors, were tasked with three very important tasks, and these tasks were: one was to disrupt the supplies being transported Ho Chi Minh Trail. Two was to protect radio towers that was allowing the United States Army to communicate. And also three was to rescue pilots that were shot down. Now, it was estimated that for every United States pilot that was saved, 30 Hmong or Laotian individuals' lives would be lost in exchange for one pilot. Now, at the fall of Saigon, and also the withdrawal of the United States forces, there was an attempt to persecute the Hmong community and also the Laotian, those individuals, basically anybody that was opposing the communist regime that was happening, that was occurring down there. At the conclusion of the war, it was estimated that approximately 25% of all men and women, all men and young boys of the Hmong population there was died from fighting, and that did not include all the deaths, civilian deaths, all the women and children's death, and all the casualties from the journey from Laos to Thailand. So there was approximately 300,000 people of Hmong descent that lived in Laos during that time, which is approximately about the same population in the United States right now. So and eventually they ended up coming to the United States here through state sponsorship. But from my understanding, members of the United States government actually tried to hit the fact that they employed this guerrilla unit to help. And that's why most of these individuals were known as the Secret Army.
That was Yileng Zhang explaining the role Hmong soldiers played in the Vietnam War. It was part of our discussion on legislation that could have impacted many Hmong residents who are now calling North Central Wisconsin home. We continued our political coverage in 2020 with Wisconsin Public Radio Rural Communities reporter Rob Menser. He served as guest host for a look at Wisconsin's political landscape ahead of the presidential primary. We also hosted a mayoral debate between Wausau Mayor Rob Mielke and Katie Rosenberg, who ultimately won that election in April. But all our plans for future programs changed dramatically when news of the pandemic began to spread, shifting our lives in ways we could have never imagined in just a few short weeks. It all started in mid-March when Governor Tony Evers issued the first of two Safer at Home orders. Businesses closed, schools switched to virtual learning, concerts and festivals were postponed and then canceled, and residents were left wondering how to cope and how to keep themselves safe. At Route 51, we launched a four-part series on coping with COVID-19, tackling the science behind the virus, the economic fallout, and the emotional toll the pandemic was taking on all our lives. As part of that series, we turned our attention to the kitchen with the help of Stevens Point chef Christian Shirwanka. He's better known as Chef C. He helped us with fresh cooking ideas in our pandemic cooking school. With restaurants closed, more families were eating at home, and it's a trend that's continuing into the new year. Chef C joined us to share easy recipes, ways to get the whole family involved in cooking, and some great grilling advice, too.
Are you big on grilling? I would imagine with your restaurants, you probably are, yes?
Definitely. We do tons of grilling. Grilling's an awesome way to obviously add flavor, so whether it's fish or meats or even vegetables. A lot of times when I'm grilling, I'll marinate or brine different things that I'm using. If I'm grilling like meats and things like that, a lot of times I'll take my steaks and my chops and, you know, ribs and things like that, and I'll put them into a brine. And brine kind of injects flavor and kind of moisture into that meat that you're going to kind of be kind of grilling later on. If I'm doing like things like vegetables or fish, a lot of times I'll do like a light marinade on that, where I'll use olive oil, fresh herbs and garlic, and even like balsamic vinegar, and kind of toss that stuff all together and let that sit for at least a couple hours before you grill it, because what that's going to do is it's going to kind of be absorbed into the meat or into the vegetables that you're working with, or fish, whatever it is. And that's going to kind of just make it taste more flavorful when you go to grill it.
So the best kind of marinade, should you buy something, or is there something easy that you can make for a marinade?
I just like making stuff at home, to tell you the truth. I'll usually use some kind of oil. You can use an olive oil or vegetable oil. I like throwing some soy sauce in there. So having that soy sauce on hand is good. Worcestershire sauce is another good one to use. Worcestershire is a good sauce that's kind of got a lot of what they call umami flavors. So it kind of gives you that earthy kind of flavor in the background. Fresh herbs, dried herbs, things like rosemary, parsley, fresh garlic is great to have on hand for stuff like this. Green onions I'll chop up in there. I'll use citrus sometimes. I'll take orange, lemons, limes, and I'll make thin slices of those and kind of put that in there. I'll take sesame oil if I want to kind of put like an Asian flair on there. I'll take a marinade and I'll do like sesame oil with even some sriracha. Sometimes I'll get some sambal, which is like a dried chili paste that they use sometimes, curry pastes, curry powders. You know, so there's a lot of direction you can kind of go, kind of like we were talking earlier, just about using those different flavors you have in your pantry and, you know, put those into your marinade.
That was Chef C with his pandemic cooking school, giving some great advice for people who find themselves spending more and more time in the kitchen. The discussion on police shootings also took center stage in 2020. In Wausau, police shot and killed an armed man on the city's west side. It was an incident that was caught on video and shared widely on social media. That prompted us to ask, so what is reasonable force? And how are police shootings investigated? Wausau Police Chief Ben Bliven and Portage County District Attorney Louis Malepsky joined us to explain the procedures unique to Wisconsin in this informative segment.
So is there ever a scenario in which, say, an officer might have violated internal policy, maybe didn't act the way that your department would dictate, but that response, that violation doesn't necessarily rise to the level of breaking the law? Is that a possibility too?
Yeah, absolutely. That's certainly a possibility. You know, we provide a lot of training to our officers in terms of and have expectations in terms of how to communicate to somebody, how to try to de-escalate a situation, use alternative force options, what type of tactics they might use to keep themselves safe and potentially prolong, a situation so that they don't have to use force. So there's a lot of variables that we might put it, you know, that we put into play in terms of policy and procedure, but that yet, you know, might not rise to the level of criminal conduct.
So, Louis, what factors do you look at from a legal standpoint when deciding how to handle a case like this? Is it all about the law, or do factors like the officer's training and time on the job, the experience, does that all matter?
Well, the simple answer is all of the above, but the most critical analysis is under the Wisconsin jury instructions. There is a committee made up of judges that meets regularly that puts together instructions that the jury uses to determine if, at a trial, if there is sufficient evidence, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, to convict a person. And under the jury instructions for the applicable action, the DA should have those next to him or her as they're looking through the evidence, investigative reports, to determine if there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime occurred. Now, I have to back up a little bit, which is we look at these reports by first determining whether or not the shooting was done in an official capacity, for example. For example, a person who is pointing a firearm at a law enforcement officer is given instructions to drop the firearm, makes an aggressive move toward law enforcement, likely that would be considered and is shot then by law enforcement and ultimately subsequently dies, that would be a justified shooting from that perspective. The DA then would go in to determine, for example, if there's other things that were known to law enforcement before they shot, for example, if there's anything else there, and that's why these investigations get into everything from the officers' text messages that they may be texting each other, if there was any prior concerns with that officer and the decedent, for example, there was bad blood between them. I mean, these reports are very go into the actions of the officer. Because ultimately, the public has a right and expectation to know that when lethal force is used, it's used appropriately. And as we look at the Department of Justice website, since 2015, there's 69 reports there, 69 deaths, about 13.8 per year. And those reports, which are all made public after the DA determines that charges will not be filed, that the public can then see that complete analysis has been done, because what the legislature wanted, the DA wants, and the police wanted is that there's no feeling that this was we'll let Officer X go because they're an officer and you know maybe they had a bad day and they shouldn't have shot, but they're an officer, so we'll give them a pass that we wouldn't give the average citizen. That's something that the DA's absolutely has to root out. And in my work as the WDA president and in my own officer-involved shootings, I mean, that's something they just have not seen. So that's the public needs to understand that the analysis here is very in-depth. And I spent about 4 months investigating mine, 2 months longer than DA Whetstone did in hers, because I had some other issues that I went through.
That was Portage County District Attorney Louis Molepsky. It was part of a discussion with Wausau Police Chief Ben Bliven on officer-involved critical incidents, including fatal shootings. Our annual gardening show came at a time when more people were staying home and paying attention to their lawns and gardens, thanks to the pandemic, which continued to affect our lives much longer than we expected. Two local chamber leaders joined us to discuss their efforts to assist businesses in crisis. And in place of our annual Energy Fair preview, we featured two experts on alternative energy. Then in June, we turned our attention to the changing criminal justice landscape with its discussion on Marcy's Law, legislation that resulted in significant adjustments to the local court system. Here's what Marathon County District Attorney Teresa Whetstone had to say about due process and how the new legislation impacts victims' rights.
Well, I think the right to due process really emphasizes the right to be meaningfully heard. A lot of what happens is, Judge Moran said, you know, we have a victim witness coordinator in the district attorney's office, and the prosecutor has throughout the years been available to victims to speak with, for the victim to confer with about any negotiations and things of that nature. But to be meaningfully heard in the court of law, with the court being the listener, is really heightened by this constitutional amendment. And so that has changed. So we now are very cognizant in every hearing that we do. First of all, we're transitioning to almost virtually all hearings with victim crimes, whether or not they've opted in under their rights under the current statutory scheme. We now have the court proceedings on the record. So there is an opportunity for a victim at any point in time to opt in and participate in the hearing and be meaningfully heard on issues that implicate their rights. And so that is a pretty big change, because we did have hearings that were taking place, and that was fine under the prior scheme, but were taking place off the record, or scheduling was taking place off the record. That didn't afford the victim that opportunity that they now have under some of the new procedures that we have.
That was Marathon County DA Teresa Whetstone, a discussion with Circuit Judge Mike Moran about implementing Marcy's Law in Wisconsin and the effect the new law is having on victims and the entire court system. In July, Teresa Hebert from High Ground Veterans Memorial Park joined us to share a unique resource for women in the military struggling with the long-reaching impacts of sexual abuse. Then we were joined by Shawamigan School Superintendent Mark Wedding and Christine Gilmore, Superintendent of the DC Ever School District, to talk about the changing face of education and how local districts found innovative ways to continue teaching children even in the face of a devastating pandemic. Superintendent Wedding talked about how his school connected with potentially at-risk students when in-person contact wasn't always possible.
We found out that two things had to happen. One is that our counseling and our mental health people had to do everything they could to make contact with students. And if that meant virtual contact, where it was a chat, a video chat with them, that was very helpful. Every week we had our principal and counselors going out to folks' houses to meet with them. And, you know, students that kind of got lost, where we didn't hear from them for a while, the teachers had to communicate with counselors and the principals that, hey, there's somebody out there, we haven't talked to them in a while, and then they had to make contact with them. So we had them driving out and talking to them if they couldn't contact some other way. But I have to be honest with you, there's a new term out there called ghosting, where folks can avoid contact unless you drive out to their house and knock on the door. They don't have to answer an email or their phone or a request for a video conference. That's a hurdle we're going to have to face if we have some long-term virtual learning going on this year.
That was Shawamigan School Superintendent Mark Wedding, part of a discussion with DC Ever Superintendent Christine Gilmore about the challenges in education during a pandemic and how educators and school officials are responding. Looking back, there were certainly a lot of serious topics we brought forward with the help of dozens of guests in 2020. But some of our favorite moments of the year were those that touched our heart with the gift of music. Earlier in the program, we heard from Paco Frelick, one of three guests who joined us this year for an Americana music special. Another guest on the program was Adam Gruhl, perhaps best known for his work with horseshoes and hand grenades. When the pandemic kept Adam from performing at the usual festivals and venues, he spent the time writing and recording new material. Here is Adam Gruhl with his original song, Rise Again. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
In a day of darkness, try to find a little light to call your own. Well, then again, it's the company of friends and strangers and the woods that brings the meaning to the moments in all life's treasures, bads and goods. Maybe a slip and fall's just what we needed to mend our heads. I wish you, the best. Don't you lose your hope, find a flame and rise again. Build yourself a raging fire, grab a log and a pen and all. desire to shed the last year's skin. What you yearn to find on another's man. Shut that log into the fire and watch it burn to a bitter end. All the past and the future can come together to dance and sing. Wish you the best. Maybe a slip and fall, just what we needed to mend our heads. Wish you the best. Don't you lose your hope, plant a seed, we'll rise again. I wish you the best. Maybe a slip and fall's just what we needed to mend our heads. I wish you the best. Don't you lose your hope, plant a seed, we'll rise again.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. This week, it's our annual Year in Review, a look back at the challenges, changes, and conversations that marked 2020 and made it a year to remember. It was a year filled with enormous upheaval, from protests about police brutality and racial inequity to a worldwide pandemic that continues to impact our daily lives. It was also an election year, and in the months leading up to the fall election, we featured comprehensive interviews with candidates in more than a dozen statewide races, all part of our commitment to helping you make informed decisions at the ballot box. But we also strive for balance, a mix of both serious and lighthearted conversations that highlight the people and places that make North Central Wisconsin such a great place to live. One of the most fascinating shows of 2020 featured a young woman from Eagle River, Natalie Decker. She's finding success on the National Racing Circuit. She's broken several NASCAR records and is on her way to making history. Here she talks about her love of racing and how she got started. Well, congratulations on your recent successes. You've had something of a large rise in racing. It must be just so incredibly exciting for you.
It is so exciting, and racing has just been in my family for so long. It started with my dad and his brothers. They raced snowmobiles. My dad used to own the World Championship Snowmobile Derby in Eagle River, Wisconsin. So that's where I got my love for motorsports, and we still get to travel every weekend as a family and still enjoy it, how it all started.
And you mentioned your dad, Chuck, was the owner of the Eagle River Derby track. Was that your first exposure to racing?
It was. I grew up, you know, always at that track with my parents when they were working and watching my dad. He still raced once I was, he stopped when I was just born. But then once I got a little older, he started up again and I got to watch him race. And then finally, I saw a go-kart race. It was a business trip. I was with my dad. And we stopped on our way home somewhere in Wisconsin. I don't remember where. I was so young. But he just stopped on the side of the road because he saw the lights were on. And that was my first go-kart race I ever saw. And I fell in love. And I told my dad, I was like, Dad, I want to race go-karts. Like, snowmobiles are fun, but I want to race go-karts. That's what I want to do. And it took him about, like, 3 years to take me seriously. But finally, for my 9th birthday is when he got me a go-kart, and we started racing as a family.
That was NASCAR driver Natalie Decker. She's from Eagle River. It was one of our absolute favorite shows of the year as we continue our look back at 2020. In October, we turned our attention to the polarizing effects of social media, something I think most of us can relate to during this time of unprecedented political and social unrest. Dr. Catalina Toma, a University of Wisconsin professor who studies bias in communication, and UW-Stevens Point professor Dr. Kim Buchanan, a psychologist with expertise in social media, joined us to discuss the psychology behind online polarization
and how to cope with difficult social media experiences. Here's what Dr. Toma had to say about those interactions.
What is it about social media that seems to give people this license to be hurtful, saying things that they would never say to somebody's face? What do you think, Catalina?
Yeah, I have a lot of insights in that. Actually, we do quite a bit of research on that in our lab. The main framework that we take to this question is the possibility that there's an intensification effect. When we go online, the way that we understand and we connect with other people gets distorted by the medium in which the interaction occurs. And one of the big distortions is that we actually have very little information about the people we are talking to. We can see them, we can hear them, we interact based on snippets of information. And sometimes people share very benign things that don't activate a great deal of emotion, but sometimes people share deeply felt emotional things and beliefs that they hold dearly, especially in this political environment that we live in today. So when we don't have a lot of information about our interlocutor, the only thing that we hear or read about them is an opinion that is extreme to us, right, that we feel very strongly about, we tend to respond in kind of this intensified, exaggerated way. So we might think that they're all good or all bad according to our own preconceived ideas. So, you know, if I am leaning a certain way politically and I'm seeing information from somebody who's leaning completely differently and that's all I see and that's all I hear about them, I tend to respond in an intensified and exaggerated way compared to face-to-face. So that's why people kind of get into it and would say things online that they might not say face-to-face. And I should say that this dynamic works similarly for positive presentations as well. We can form deep connections and perceive a lot of affinity with people we don't know quite well just because we feel that we agree or share a view that's really important or central to us. And that's one of the reasons why people tend to fall in love quite quickly online and to develop relationships quite quickly. And then maybe those relationships suffer once you meet face-to-face, once you have more elaborate interactions, because then you discover the person in the fullness of their humanity, right? You get a lot more information about them.
That was Dr. Catalina Toma, who joined Dr. Kim Buchanan for a discussion on the polarizing nature of social media interactions and how to navigate when things get uncomfortable. Also in October, we took you on a tour of the strangest and most unusual places to visit in North Central Wisconsin. We presented an update on the coronavirus pandemic just as cases in the region were starting a rapid climb. And we talked with educators on the continued challenges faced by schools, educators, and students. Then in November, we had a serious conversation about the prevalence of hate groups in our area with the help of two experts in the field, Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky, formerly of UW-Whitewater, and Dr. Robert Futrell, a sociology professor with the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. They joined us for a discussion on extremism and what fuels the kind of hatred we see far more frequently now than ever before. Here, Dr. Futrell explains how recruitment to such groups happens. Robert, how does recruitment happen? I mean, does somebody just say, I'm a Klansman or I'm a member of this? How does it happen?
Well, sometimes it works that way, sure. You know, we may have a sense that when we talk about the white supremacy movement, it's some kind of highly organized, directed from a top-down set of organizations. It doesn't look like that. It's much more about the networks and overlapping networks that move between, you know, what we would call white supremacy groups all over to, say, anti-government extremists, patriot movement, militia movement. It doesn't mean that any one group is all of one type or another, but the networks interact. And so you can claim affiliation very easily by connecting in a chat room on a website that is affiliated with, say, a white supremacy group. You may not run that website, and that's another step into being a part of the movement. But there's real broad gradations of involvement that can happen. And so in terms of recruitment, we've seen it happen in house parties. Some of those house parties, if you've ever been to a house party with a band and there's music happening and the band takes a break, and then, you know, the next set starts, and all of a sudden they've taken off their jackets and there's neo-Nazi insignia on, and people start talking to folks who are new to the group and start relating, you know, a particular vision of the world, asking them if they face problems in their lives, and then translating those through a white supremacist point of view. Now, that doesn't mean anybody that is engaged in that way then becomes a white supremacist, but they're able to pick off people in it. And like I said, a lot of that is pulling them into networks where they feel a sense of belonging and a sense of camaraderie and a sense.
That was Dr. Robert Futrell with his take on recruitment and radicalization, part of our discussion on hate groups and extremism in our region. Also in November, we aired a discussion on COVID-19 and mental health, and we welcomed Tonda Nicholson, a polysomnographic technologist from Aspirus Healthcare, for an in-depth look at the science of sleep, from what happens to our brains when we dream to the physical effects of sleep disorders and how they're identified. Here's a clip from that program.
Tonda, this has been such a difficult year. So many reasons. I mean, it's the stress of the coronavirus pandemic. With all of this, are you seeing more sleep disruption, more sleep disorders than you have in the past?
Yes, actually, unfortunately, all of it. And what we're seeing also is that the lack of sleep, because it is so important to our immune system, there's a protein in our bodies that gets secreted during the deep wave sleep. And I always go back to that deep wave sleep. And the most intense is that seventh and eighth hour of sleep. This is how important for our overall health, our longevity of health, that we hit 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And the reason why is because our immune system, our metabolism is the proteins that strengthen our immune system are secreted during that deep wave sleep. And because of that, the COVID patients and the worrisome and everything that we're worried about, the jobs, the families, the lack of connection with people causes lack of sleep.
That was Tonda Nicholson with a look at the science of sleep and how it affects our immune system and metabolism, especially in the age of COVID-19. Before we wrapped up the year, my colleague, Wisconsin Public Radio Central Regional Manager Rick Ryer, stepped in as guest host for what has become an annual event, a sci-fi special with Iola author John Jackson Miller. We explored the origins of our holiday traditions and got into the spirit of things with the help of Mosinee pianist and songwriter John Altenberg. His annual Christmas extravaganza at Wausau's Grand Theater was canceled this year due to the pandemic, but John and fellow musician Mitch Vigut shared with us some of their favorite past performances and gave us a behind-the-scenes look at the annual sold-out show, which features incredible musicians from across the region. We hope next year you'll be able to see it once again in person. Earlier in today's program, we heard from Paco Frelick and Adam Gruhl, two area musicians who joined us for our Americana-themed Thanksgiving special. Here is another incredible performance from that show, this time from Ariane Lydon, a song called Winter's Run.
Summer spreading rumors of coats of many colors, but the dew is holding while the sky is folding. I'm making my migration down to Arizona, where the days are longer. Days are warmer. Summer's dropping shadows and harvesting its secrets, wrapping them in paper. present them to winter. The mist has closed its curtain on flowers in the meadow. But the stars grow bolder as the stars the night burns colder.
That was Ariane Lydon, an unforgettable live performance of Winter's Run, one of three musicians who joined us for an Americana Thanksgiving back in November. This concludes our annual year in review, a year like no other as we look forward to 2021. I'd like to thank all our guests over the past 12 months and our listeners, too. We appreciate every one of you. I'm Shereen Seward. Our producer is Joy Ratch-Kramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's and all our programs at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, we'll host a discussion on the vaccine rollout. Until then, we're heading out of town.